Welcome back to the Football Fitness Federation podcast. This is episode 286. This episode is with Ben Simons. Ben's a physical preparation coach at Semtex Systems. And I spoke to Ben about a number of different topics, including periodizing plyometrics in season, where his focus lies in terms of plyometrics during a busy schedule. We spoke about some of the exercises to use. We then talked about speed developments, what the focus was in season, and some common areas players need to focus their work, especially on any time during the season where schedules free up a little bit, where you end up with an international break or just a gap in fixtures. How can we utilise that time, and where Ben spends his time and his focus with players during those periods as well? I've said this before, but I just want to say a big thank you, because I've had quite a few people reaching out recently, dropping messages privately on social media, just saying how much they're taking away from the podcast. I really appreciate every single comment that comes in that's similar to that, whether it's in public or in private. It means a lot, because we never know. These episodes, obviously, we can see the views, we can see certain comments on the episodes. But in terms of takeaways, I ask for them each week on every episode, and we don't always get it. So it's really nice to hear the episodes people have taken the most from, and some of the guests have enjoyed listening to as well. And that also gives us a little bit of an idea on future episodes, future guests, or even getting people back onto the podcast as well. So big thank you to anyone that's recently reached out and dropped a message over. Just before we get into the episode, a massive thank you to our sponsors, The Good Prep. The Good Prep is a meal prep delivery service that provides fresh, ready-to-eat, chef-cooked meals straight to your door. They offer meal plans tailored to your personal goals, current activity level, and schedule. The Good Prep works closely with elite-level athletes and corporates to develop meal solutions that meet the ever-changing demands of performance and training. Their clients include Brighton Hove Albion, the PGMOL, Commonwealth Teams, Gymshark, and many more. Their meals are full of all the nutrients you need to keep you in peak performance so you can achieve every goal you set. Plus, you can reclaim your time, eat better, move more, and reduce food waste too. Their meal plans are designed to guide you through your journey to a healthier you. Take the guesswork out of healthy eating and discover the power of nutrition at thegoodprep.com, and make sure you use the code FFF15 for 15% off your first order. This podcast is brought to you by Hytro, the number one BFR brand in pro sport, helping teams and athletes improve performance and recover faster with their blood flow restriction wearables. Built for sport and proven by science, check out Hytro.com to find out more. Also, a huge thank you to Rezl, the world's leading VR sports trainer, and it's amazing to see the most recent partnership they've announced with the Premier League, teaming up to shape the future of football experiences for fans and players. So amazing work by everyone at Rezl. Massive congratulations for all the hard work going into that. And let's get into episode 286 with Ben Simons.
Rezl is the world's number one virtual reality sports trainer. Whatever your team, your sport, your ability, improve your game and train like a pro. Rezl. Reactions, performance, accuracy, stamina, resilience. Train at home in the Rezl Sports and Fitness VR Training Arena. Search Rezl, R-E-Z-Z-I-L. Harder, stronger, smarter. The world's number one virtual reality sports trainer. Available now on MetaQuest.
Welcome back to the Football Fitness Federation podcast. This is episode 286. I'm delighted to welcome onto the podcast today Ben Simons. How are we doing, Ben?
I'm good, thank you. Thanks for having me on the show. How are you?
I'm very good, mate. I'm very good. And I've got to say thank you to a mutual friend, mutual colleague. That is Steve Thompson, who was on recently, that put us in touch. So big thanks to Steve.
Absolutely. Thanks to Dr. Steve.
Steve's turned into a bit of a machine, isn't he, from his training recently as well? We're going for Olympics, maybe Commonwealth?
We might set the bar a little lower at first, but he's getting quicker, Steve. Yeah, he's practicing what he preaches on the speed side of things. So I've been overseeing some of his sprint training, which has been a really cool project for both of us.
Class. No, that's awesome. It's obviously something we're going to cover on the podcast today, around speed and power, plyometric work with players and
tapping into your experience, but we always start these episodes in the same way, Ben, and that's on you and your experience, your career so far. So can you give us a little rundown?
So, yeah, I'm a relatively green coach, really. I'm only 2 years out of retirement from Olympic sport myself. So I was a Team GB bobsleigh athlete. Went to 3 Olympic Games over a 10, 11-year career. Background in many different sports. I was a multi-sport youth athlete, played a lot of sports at kind of county to regional level. But I competed in long jump as a junior at national and international level. So that was the best sport for me, really, as far as level of competition. Studied sports science at uni. So was passionate about training and training theory from a young age. And at that point, I'd had 2 surgeries on my feet and ankles. This is at only 19, 20 years old. So I'd stopped jumping at that point and was competing in the sprints and competing for Wales at that point. Still had a couple of international vests and was aiming really at that point maybe to go to a Commonwealth Games, but didn't really have any bigger ambition than that at that point and was just enjoying doing it alongside my time studying. And basically went through a talent ID transition pathway to bobsleigh, which was really quite a random turn of events. There was a poster literally in my university training facility with a picture of 4 big blokes jumping into a sled. It said, could you push your country at the next Olympic Games? And I thought, I'm probably too small to do that. The boats look huge, but the tests, I like the look of the tests. It was a 45-meter sprint, standing long jump, squat, and the bench press, which was my area. Like, I was really good at those tests. So I thought, if anything, I'd be good at, I'd just put down some good numbers. Maybe skeleton would be interesting because the guys tend to be a bit smaller. But no, I went along to that testing session, did well, got invited to the University of Bath for the push tests because we've got a dry land push facility there. So think of the scene as Cool Runnings when they're driving that go-kart down a hill. It's just a slightly more technical version of that, but it's on rails, so you can't actually fall off the thing. A couple of people have fallen off, but it's harder to fall off the thing. And at that point, it's just pushing a certain time on that push track to see if you can make it to the next stage in the team. I was too light, way too light, but I put on a lot of mass over my career, a lot in the first couple of years, which led to some further issues, but still it got me into the sport and a long and pretty decent career. And during that time, I was still competing, still doing a master's. So I finished my undergraduate sports science, did master's sports science, and then started the online training thing a few years in, because I was kind of forced into the online world because we lost our UK sport funding. So anybody that's not aware of how the funding works for Olympic sports compared to professional sports, the UK National Lottery funds those Olympic sports, and that's all based on your results and what's going on within the sport. We didn't have a great result in Pyeongchang 2018 Olympics, so lost our funding there. And at that point, I thought, well, I need something remote that I can do to earn money while we were away on tour, because we were away for 5-6 months of the year. I started the online stuff, and that led actually to the in-person coaching. It's kind of weird. That's happening more and more. That would never have happened in the past. It was always you're a coach first, and there was a platform for you to put out your expertise online and set up some online remote work with athletes from that. Whereas obviously what we're seeing now with the explosion of online training is you've got a lot of online coaches first, or all completely online, and then perhaps moving into in-person afterwards. I was lucky to move into in-person very, very quickly. Again, I was forced in the summers when I was home. Obviously that gave me an opportunity to work with people in person, and I made some very good friends at Sheffield Hallam University and was able to join in with research projects and get some work experience and stuff like that, working with people, and went from there. Really, 2 years in, I've worked with athletes from ultimate frisbee to Premier League football, so there's been a complete spectrum of athletes that I've worked with, but I'm enjoying the journey. So Yeah, that is hopefully a brief overview of me and my background.
Love it, love it. I want to dive into that in a second in terms of, I always like speaking to people that have been involved in different sports on their views of football and maybe how we prepare players for football as well. But just before we do that, how have you found the transition from athlete to coach?
Yeah, that's a very good question and a pertinent point, I think. It's something that isn't, I think it's highlighted more so probably in football than a lot of other sports. We see how players that retire can often struggle with that transition. I see a lot of players now being a lot more forward thinking with getting their coaching badges and stuff and thinking about what they're going to do in the future. But you do see people having difficulty transitioning. I didn't expect it to be a difficult transition because I kind of had my toe in the coaching camp already. I was, over the last 4 years, still training full time, the last 4 year cycle of my Olympic career, but I was coaching on the side. So I thought, well, it's fine because I just drop the one thing and I go all into the other thing. I'm going to put all my energy into that. But it's a huge change because the main thing is your routine and schedule completely gets thrown out the window. So I was always bound by the constraints of the schedule that my sport set. And it would be the same for any Olympic or professional sports person. And then everything else slotted in around that. So suddenly when it came to me scheduling myself, it was much harder. You almost become slightly institutionalized with knowing if you've had a 10-year career in a sport or in a system, you know that game day is this day, first day of training, I'm back in here. My training day is like this. I've got to be at the park at 8, 9 o'clock. Maybe it's physio first, lunch at this time, train, and then time's your own in the afternoon, evening, prepare, and then go back the next day. You get very institutionalized doing that for 10, 15, 20 years for some people, coming out the other side and then having a load of free time. At first, it's like, oh, great. But then for me, certainly, I almost yearned a bit of structure and obviously tried to set that up for myself and do set that up for myself now just through coaching and my different appointments I'll have with athletes and clients throughout the day. But yeah, difficult transition, not easy.
Yeah, no, and I think you're right. You do see it a lot in football, don't you, of players transitioning. And obviously the PFA and other organisations do a good job of guiding players along that journey as well, I know. But no, it's interesting to tap into your experience of it. Sorry, Ben, go on.
Yeah, I would say that's one thing that I think is definitely missing in many non-professional or Olympic sports, that there isn't as much support afterwards as they could be. And it's nice to hear that football is doing that a little bit better.
Yeah, no, definitely. Just on the sport of bobsleigh then, what can we take if you're a complete novice and you only maybe catch a couple of minutes of it on every time the Olympics is on, like myself, and yeah, without knowing the preparation that goes into it? You've briefly touched on there some of the tests that you saw initially when you first got into the sport, but now, with the experience that you've got and the experience you've got working with footballers, is there anything we can learn that sort of transfers across?
Well, certainly the emphasis on acceleration is a big one for any field sport, really. Obviously, acceleration is huge. And just some of the methods around developing acceleration can transfer readily to football and rugby and many sports where acceleration is important. I think that's one thing that a lot of the methods for just building power and rate of force development and the mechanics of acceleration specifically are really honed in on those for bobsleigh because it's a hugely acceleration dominant sport. So that has been the main takeaway that I think could transfer to other sports. It's obviously completely different. It's so specialized, but that specific side is obviously a side that can transfer. Because the other thing is as well is obviously when we're accelerating the sled, we're moving a external object, but we test a lot of acceleration just pure sprinting on the side. And it's interesting how the act of pushing heavy sleds and moving heavy objects through acceleration will improve your acceleration ability, even at much heavier loads. So I think traditionally, and some of the the research around this is now becoming clear that in the past, people used to say you don't want to reduce your velocity by, I forget the number, it's like 5 or 10%. Don't use a sled weight that's going to slow you down that much, or it's going to mean your mechanics break down and it's going to cause problems in your acceleration. But that doesn't seem to be the case. You can use very heavy loads in acceleration. So I'll use a heavy prowler. Most gyms, especially nowadays, because gyms have got a lot better, a lot of them will have a strip of turf and a prowler in them. Guys can get in and do some really good work on a prowler for acceleration, not just the physical development and the qualities you need and the specific musculature, but also some of the the mechanical stuff that you need to improve for acceleration. And that can be dosed into your gym sessions. Haven't got a lot of distance in the gym, but you can get on that prowler and do some work, hit some key positions and learn and develop the qualities you need to accelerate well.
Yeah, no, it's a great point. I think on that as well, that the resistance side of things where we get sort of, yeah, I know it's different now, but previously we got talked away from the heavy, real heavy work, didn't we? But if you relate it to different exercises, like a squat, for example, it's something that we've always periodized anyway, isn't it? That if you're on a periodized cycle, there's probably going to be a cycle of time where you're going to be working in that heavier way. But with the sled or the prowler, we seem to have thought that it was different in some way.
Yeah, it was like different camps, wasn't it? It was like here's strength, here's speed.
Yeah.
And they need to be completely separate. But then all of the kind of special strength stuff that came out of Russia and Verkhoshansky and co, they all loved doing exercises that were kind of somewhere in the middle. I just think there's another side, probably more from the US side, that's been general strength in the gym. Speed here, completely different, don't mix the two. But also, especially with the velocity of things, pushing a prowler obviously way slower than accelerating. If you're trying to teach key positions, and I'd always rather force people into key positions than have to over cue them, especially footballers, they'll get frustrated if you just cue the hell out of them. It's just one small element of this very complex game they've got to play. I'd rather use constraints to push some key positions and make some mechanical changes. Parallel is really good. It slows the movement down. Skill acquisition is going to be easier because it's slower and they can feel those key positions. So that's a great, I'd say that is one of the biggest takeaways. Pushing and pulling heavier implements can improve acceleration, will improve acceleration.
Yeah, no, definitely. And you've seen it used more and more with players and clubs now as well, aren't you? So that is definitely something that is becoming common practice in a lot of clubs. One thing I wanted to sort of focus this episode around was tapping into your experience around working with players in season and getting some of the work that you do with players in terms of explosiveness, in terms of speed development in season, how that's actually structured. So starting with plyometric work that you're doing with players, what are some of your thoughts around periodizing? When we're looking at these hectic schedules, these 2-3 game weeks and some, even more at the minute as well, which is mental. But these weeks that are just crazy schedules, how does that impact your periodizing of plyometric work with players?
Yeah, it's very, very difficult. And one real big difficulty I've had is that I haven't yet had a player consistently that I've programmed from off-season into pre-season into season at the level where the schedule is as hectic as you'll see at, you know, a Premiership team where they're playing Champions League and Premiership and everything else. But I have had to program players at that level just straight off the bat as well, without really having much time with them, which has been really, really, really difficult. I'd say with the plyometrics in that case, it's important to make the distinction between multi-jumps and plyometrics here, I think, and talking about ground contact times, impacts, and that overall stress on the body. So I think a lot of people will jumps and multi-jumps, so box jumps and, I don't know, like 2 or 3 standing long jumps horizontally, they'll lump those into the plyometric category, whereas strictly speaking, they're not. With ground contact times, we're talking about, for a true pure plyometric, like 150 to 200 milliseconds. And that's really quick compared to, if you think a counter movement jump's going to be, I mean, some people will be 500 milliseconds on a counter movement jump, you know, is literally twice as long on the ground. So they're vastly different things, but you can get a lot of the explosive benefits that you want to see from multi-jumps. So the guys that I've worked with in season, I'll often use multi-jumps and I'll often use them jumping up. So up onto a box, upstairs, for example, just to actually try and reduce the impact slightly, because my main focus on the in-season sessions is always going to be trying to get them up to speed and getting a quality exposure to max velocity. By and large, that's what I'm going for in these sessions, unless there's anything that tells me that we don't want to run them at top speed today. And then I'm going to bring that down to acceleration. And then that makes you think, well, how many more explosive contacts have they got on top of that? Considering we're already microdosing the speed because they've covered God knows how many kilometers in the games they've played and the training they're doing. And we have the chance now to get in and do this without any fatigue. So what I'm looking for is output. I just want high output on a non-risky exercise. So I'll mostly use, a great example is if I can get them into an indoor training center, which I'll often try to do, because we've got a warm environment, free of rain, free of wind, a good surface. So we can definitely get them up to speed. They can feel good. And usually there'll be plyometric boxes and a pole vault or high jump bed. So a good example of jumping up in a multi-jump fashion is set up a plyometric box in front of a pole vault bed. They jump up onto the box, up in the air again, land on the pole vault bed. And so they haven't got as much impact because they're not coming down from a height onto the next contact. Contact times are a little longer, but they're still getting the output and the explosive power that we're going for in those exercises. That being said, I'll often use skips. So skips for height or skips for distance, usually in the warm-up. So warming up for their speed work. And that I would still say that's a plyometric contact. It's definitely within the contact time. It's just of a true plyometric. It's just not as intense because they're essentially, they've got a penultimate step between each jump. It's not like a bound where you're coming down from a height and with maximum velocity into each contact. But we can still make some of the technical changes that we need with the skips. So I'll often introduce plyometrics as well by using skipping. And from a specific standpoint, it's also going to drill them to jump well off one leg running into a contact, because that's so important for contesting a header in football, is running into a jump and jumping off one leg. And so that's just another way to get some quality contacts in, because by and large, that's what I'm looking for, is microdosing, minimum effective dose here. There's very little capacity, very little left within there. If we think of it as like a bucket and we're filling that bucket up with water and that's all they're training, with the schedule they've got, there's very little left, really. But what we can do is kind of get the lowest hanging fruit here in the small time I've got with them and just go for some output in the with the least risk possible. And I just see risk with doing higher intensity plyometric movements in season, unless I've worked with them over a good amount of time leading into the season. So I have goalkeepers that I've worked with off season, pre-season, I've worked with for years, and I can do that all of their programming for them. I'll have much higher volumes of plyometrics in season, A, because I know that they can handle them and I've coached them to do plyometrics properly, and B, just because reactive and elastic strength is way more important for a keeper and they're covering less volume on the field anyway. So their training looks completely different. They're just very, very different training programs. And I've been lucky to work with quite a few keepers now, which is they're a really cool cohort of athletes to work with.
I love that. I think that's a great point as well in terms of the sort of training age of the player and the athlete, but also the time spent with you as well as a coach. I think that's really crucial, isn't it? But I suppose the hard thing off the back of that comes when coaches are working within a team environment and you've got however many players of all different abilities and all different experiences in terms of jump training or plyos as well.
Yeah, plyos, they're not many people know how to coach players, and unless you come from a jump background, there's very little emphasis placed on how to do plyometrics properly. And also, there's not really any consensus on what is correct with, like, the ground contact and what a pure plyometric is. And there's a whole lot of mystique around it almost. And I think because of that, people struggle to, they just think, well, we'll just throw in a few hurdle hops or just make them do some bounds. And I'm like, yeah, I see a lot of people trying to do bounds really badly. And you're just asking for shin pain, Achilles pain, knee pain. And when you're working with people whose performance week in, week out is so important, like, why risk that? Why risk that? When I'm looking at what I'm going to use for these players in season, that isn't number one priority. Number one priority for me, especially as I'm mostly a speed coach, is getting them up to speed and getting an appropriate exposure to maximum velocity, and then just getting some high output. And that would be max strength as well as some sort of jumping or throwing exercise. I didn't notice that, and this is something that is very underutilized, explosive throws. Explosive throws are a great way to get a lot of the benefits that you want from plyometrics at a systemic level, without some of the risks and the risks of overuse injury at the lower limbs. So yeah, along with the jumps up that I mentioned before, overhead throws for distance. And it's great and it's good fun for the guys. You know, if you, especially if you get a few into one session, you set up a cone, everybody's trying to beat one another. I've never seen somebody get hurt doing those. And I've always seen people get massive outputs, because if your mate goes and throws the ball further than you, or even if there's a tape measure out and you didn't get as far as last week, intent goes through the roof. That's it. That's output ticked. I'm good. Good to go. Yeah. And if you can microdose that through a season, then come end of the season, I think their speed and power capabilities are going to be trending way higher than they would have been if they hadn't been doing any of that microdosing of high outputs.
Also with the throws, it's the saving on coaching time, isn't it? Because
yeah, massively.
Because especially taking a group, you could probably take a whole group through a really effective session using throws. That if you're going to do something like plyos or something else, maybe a little bit more complex, that's going to take a lot more time, isn't it, than setting that up?
Absolutely, especially if you're working with a whole team.
Yeah.
Like, to teach pure plyometrics, it's like you need, even with one athlete, you need a good bit of time. And, you know, I'm not somebody that believes, oh, well, you need to hit all of these measures, 2 times body weight squat, X, Y, and Z. I don't believe any of that needs to be something that needs to be hit. And it's not a prerequisite to jump, because we were all doing plyometrics as kids playing in the playground. So, but still, the technical side of it, things can go very wrong. Like, I just see bounds are a good one. I'll see bounds thrown into many a sprint warm-up, and what people are doing isn't bounding. And there's a lot of sore shins. There's a lot of sore shins because they're bounding badly, and because they've got a huge amount of volume elsewhere in their playing and training schedule anyway.
It's a very exciting time on our online community at the moment, because over our last 5 networking events at down in Battersea at FSCR and Blackburn Rovers, Colchester United, Everton, and the most recent one at West Bromwich Albion, we've had 13 presentations on a number of different topics that have all been recorded, and over the next few weeks will be uploaded onto our online community. So if our members haven't been able to get to those events, then they'll be able to watch the presentations back and take a hell of a lot of information from those as well. There's also, on top of those 13, there's an extra 150 plus hours of content available on the community right now. So if you're interested in seeing what it's all about, go to footballfitfed.com, click the community tab, sign yourself up there, and give you a 30-day free trial. After your free trial, you become a paid member on the community, and you get invited into our WhatsApp group, as well as getting continued access to all the great information on there and some exciting stuff we've got to come over the next few months as well. So go and check it out, footballfitfed.com, click your community tab, sign yourself up there to a free trial, a free 30-day trial. Here's part 2 of the podcast with Ben Simons.
Yeah, and I think that's the other thing, isn't it? Looking at the big picture, because if we're looking solely at the sessions that we're putting on and the volume that we're exerting on a player, that's only one piece of the puzzle, isn't it? When you stack everything else on top of it, like you've mentioned with playing time and training time and the rest of it, suddenly you've got that creep. Well, it's not creeping your volume up, it's sending your volume up pretty high, isn't it?
Massively, yeah. They've just got so much on that plate. It's such a huge volume to deal with. Often I'll microdose into warm-ups and post-session as well. So the harder, you know, on-pitch session of the week, training-wise, we might microdose some explosive throws, sprints, or multi-jumps into the warm-up. And then on the easier day, it might be that they just put in a microdose at the end.
Yeah.
Yeah, so if they haven't been able to see me in person, just to make sure they get the exposures to output and or max V that's needed. And then also looking at, you know, if you're working with somebody, if a footballer is with you specifically as your coach, which is often not the case, you're dealing with many different coaches because you're dealing with the club. You might be dealing with another outside S&C coach, another outside physio, etc. You're part of a larger team. But if you can get access to the numbers, i.e., you know, because GPS is rolled out in many, many of the leagues now, even lower league, you can get how much distance they've covered and top speed as well. It's top speed exposures. You can kind of work out how many more exposures they might need that week. Or they might have already covered. They might have covered it.
Yeah.
You know, if they're a fullback and they've had a lot of, you know, high velocity sprints in a game, you probably don't need to do very much with them. But if you get them fresh, not fatigued, in a warm environment with a good warm-up, you're still probably going to get them to above what they reached on the pitch that week, which is a kind of super max effort, which does a lot of things. Obviously, it's going to keep their max velocity up throughout a long and grueling season. But it's almost like also kind of inoculation to the hamstrings, you know? The hamstrings usually go at high speed. So if you get them above the speed or at least close to max V, with some microdosed exposures, then that's going to create a kind of inoculation for the hamstrings, or at least reduce risk of hamstring injury. And it also gives you a chance to look at how they're moving, because you're going to spot any aberrant or wayward mechanics that could expose them to injury risk.
Yeah, definitely. How does your approach then differ, Ben, in season when... it's very rare, I know, but you might get a player who has a break for a week, possibly 2 weeks, so international windows, or for whatever reason, we've got a block of time in season where we can get some work into players. What would be the sort of difference in approach?
Yeah, so I'd load them up. I'd see an opportunity like that. It's almost sometimes a godsend for a coach. You're like, oh, good, I've got no competing variables here, and we can just get some work in. I've got a goalkeeper at the moment who, through some, and this is another thing dealing with kind of politics and all stuff that goes on in football, through some weird loan agreement versus politics between loan club that he's with, etc. This keeper was benched for a while, even though he was the top keeper at the club, doing really, really well. And he was playing exceptionally. So he's like, mate, for the foreseeable, you know, I'm training, but I'm not playing. So I'm like, okay, let's go for it. Let's load you up. So yeah, we take the shackles off, we get them in the gym. Max strength is often, you know, obviously along with max velocity, but we're talking about a goalkeeper here.
Yeah.
The max velocity side, I still sprint them, because it's just the development for the central nervous system. But also their hamstrings take a hammering with the long balls. So I'm very careful with it. Max strength, really lowest hanging fruit here. So really good amount of max strength and a lot of high output stuff, multi-jumps, explosive throws, more players with the keepers. Anyway, he's done this for a few weeks, got back on the field, and yeah, it's just given him a new lease. This was just before Christmas, leading into the new year, just came out flying. You know, he got that extra big dose of training in. It's almost like a periodized approach with like track and field, where you might have early year competitions where you've got to qualify for Olympic Games as World Championships. And then you go back into training, come back out again, peak again. So you can almost do that kind of super compensation peak trough. Gave him a big load, and then he got back on the field, tapered him off slightly, back into an in-season approach, and he's absolutely flying. So yeah, I just see them as a nice opportunity to get some good work in. And that is often when players may come up and see me, if they've got that kind of break.
I think there's two ways that players will go in that period, isn't there? They'll either do that and they'll go and get that work in and reach out to someone like yourself that knows that it's an opportunity to work differently, get in that work and come back in a better position. But the battle, I think, with a lot is that players just want to stop. Players want to just step away because they've had busy periods. And
yeah,
kind of understand it because they've had quite a bit on. But I suppose the education side of it there is really needed, isn't it? To say, yes, you've not got your game load, but for you to play out the remaining however many months of the season, we need to get you at this level. And that's exactly what you've referred to then, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's a different load, you know. Just the stress of playing 90 minutes two or three times a week sometimes, that's different to being able to get them in, offering a little bit more density to their strength training, doing some more explosive work. And you would hope that the kind of aerobic and endurance benefits that they got through playing that often over the last few weeks, we know that those adaptations last longer. So for an international break, for example, it's not a particularly long period. You can kind of go in, you're changing really the emphasis of the training. So I haven't noticed, they're going to come in with niggles, but you work around that, right? And more often than not, appropriate strength training can offer a bit of a solution to a lot of those niggles as well. So yeah, you know, obviously I've flown in with load them up. But I would say, yeah, you've still got to be mindful, especially if someone's completely fried. But my experience has been the kind of change in approach, with it being more strength, explosive-based work, that does still offer a break from just the huge amount of volume that they're getting through playing 90 minutes of football multiple times a week.
And then do you see that difference then with these players that you've built up this strength base with as well, that you've maybe had for, I know you've said about having players for a certain amount of time, their work in season in terms of the strength exposure that they're getting in season can now be different to players that haven't seen you for as long, or the training age is a lot lower?
Yeah, I would say so. If you get in a good amount of work in the off-season and pre-season, then, I mean, we see it in the research, right? If you build up certain physical qualities, they'll last for so long. If you give appropriate doses after that, they'll last for even longer. So if you've had a good block of training in your off-season and pre-season, then that's going to take you much longer through the actual season itself. So I think, yeah, building up a good level of strength is always going to serve play as well. And it's probably is the lowest hanging fruit, really, from what I see in football. It's just not appropriate maximum strength training.
Yeah, that's one thing I was going to ask in terms of sort of common areas that players need that work. And you say that is the main one.
Yeah, so obviously for me, I'm a speed-based guy, sprint mechanics. And that's not saying that mechanics, they're not going to run like Usain Bolt, but there are some commonalities with risky movement and efficient movement in both acceleration and top speed, which can carry over from like track, for example, to football. And it's going to do three things. It's going to improve their maximum velocity and acceleration, which is going to make them quicker on the pitch in general. And it's going to make them more efficient runners, which is then indirectly going to improve their capacity, right? If they run better. And then it's going to reduce risk of injury. So if their sprint mechanics are better and less risky, it's going to reduce risk of hamstring injuries, lower back issues, groin issues, of course, tendinopathies, the Achilles. And also the exposure to high speed, we get that kind of inoculation effect, at least a little bit of injury reduction specifically at the hamstring, I would say, but everywhere. You know, if you expose somebody to a stimulus, they're going to get used to it. So yeah, for me, high speed running and running in general and sprint mechanics, max strength. Yeah, it's just massively underutilized for whatever reason. And I can understand, because it's many generations away from what's going on the football pitch, right? If people are skeptical about speed and sprint mechanics in football, because it's like, oh, it's not the same, they've got to do it for 90 minutes, even though that is a very key element to what they're doing on the pitch, then you can understand why people are skeptical about doing a squat which is but completely different. It's a completely different sport. It's, you know, from a layman's perspective, you don't see how that is related. But we all know the benefits of mass strength, max strength will carry over to marathon runners do strength work. You know, it will carry over. And I think there's just been a trend to underload players. I think we're seeing that massively, especially in clubs. But I think that might be, it's changing. But I think also that's, you can understand it. It's through fear and it's through risk management. It's through managers and staff maybe not believing in it or not being something that they did in their career. But I think as sports science is becoming more, there's always a kickback. You still hear people kicking back against sports science, but as sports science is becoming more and more prevalent in clubs, I'm seeing more and more good max strength work going on in clubs. I'm seeing more and more great S&Cs that I've been lucky enough to kind of speak to in the past who are working in top clubs. How much their hands are tied by who's above them. I mean, that must be a hard relationship for them to deal with, you know, manager to them, to players. But at the same time, I think it's changing. So, yeah, I'm going off track a little bit. I would say, yeah, speed and sprint mechanics, max strength, and just high outputs in general. So that's a really easy bucket to fill, right?
Yeah.
You don't need a lot of volume. It's, especially if you use the right modality, explosive throws, multi-jumps, you can get some good changes and adaptation in the players in a fun way with very little impact on the rest of the program because you just need so little volume of it.
Yeah, no, it's a great point. Yeah, what you were saying there about the squat and people looking at it in a slightly different way just reminds me of the comment that I can't remember, the Chelsea manager from years ago saying about that we don't carry laptops on the pitch or whatever the quote was. And basically saying that the sports science didn't relate. And it's like, okay, oh, right, is that where we're at, is it? But yeah, that's the kind of thing, isn't it?
Well, I'm sure I heard a quote from, I think it was Andrea Pirlo, saying the pre-match warm-up is just the strength and conditioning coach's way of masturbating. It was obviously translated from Italian, but yeah, I kind of get that. I do, yeah. Sometimes when I see ladder drills in warm-up, I'm like, yeah, they probably don't need to do that.
Yeah.
At that point, I think, I don't know, I'd be very, unless a player was, some players have been really kind of, the really keen guys want maybe my thoughts on like pre-match potentiation, stuff like that, especially the keepers, I think. And I have given them like potentiation protocols to use, but I think really at that point, players' heads need to be in the game and really quite intuitive about what they need. For me personally, as an athlete, I always had a warm-up that I thought was appropriate for myself. If you're experienced enough, I don't think your hand needs holding at that point. But it really, you've got to take the team aspect into it as well. If everybody's been an individual before a game, then how's that going to affect the team performance? So I can understand why maybe the more scheduled and strict warm-ups come in that are led by the staff.
Yeah, it's also obviously someone like that, it's also from a very technical based player, isn't it, who's had a career based on technical ability probably more than physical.
Yeah, he didn't even look like he was breaking a sweat half the time when he played. But if you've got someone that really relies on their speed, fullback, wide midfielder, you want to get them ready. Christ, they don't want to break into their first like top speed run of the game and feel like they're not ready to go. Yeah, and it's one of them. But those are the really getting into the minutiae of the sport now.
Ben, just to, before I forget, because I was going to ask you this before, when you mentioned about acceleration and putting sort of sprint mechanics as a priority for a lot of players and something that probably needs to be learn more by coaches and use more with players, what would you say are some of the common areas we should focus on in terms of what you've seen with players on improving acceleration?
Yeah, so you kind of, especially with footballers, you can really go to the simple kind of key points in acceleration. Projection is the main one. And a lot of players that, people will be skeptical about projection because they think that it makes them unbalanced. I don't expect them to be accelerating like Usain Bolt out of the blocks, head down. Obviously, head's got to be up, but it's the way you're projecting the center of mass, projecting the hips especially. And a lot of the time, they're not projecting enough, aggressively enough horizontally. And so they're kind of just running on air, you know. So learning to project, and a lot of that will come from the multi-jump and the throw work that we do as well, especially if you're jumping out and forward and throwing out and forward. So there are crossovers there to what we're doing in the explosive work or special strength work, whatever you want to call it. And I think there's a lot of issues around lumbar pelvic control as well. And this is really a lot where drills kind of get a lot of flack in the online space at the moment, from certain sides of the online space anyway. Even within track and field, there's people that are like anti-drill, you know, running drills, sprint drills. So like, it's not the same. It doesn't prepare people for X, Y, and Z. Look, it's getting you into key positions and at least allowing you to develop some movement literacy, especially around the lumbar pelvic region. And yeah, not only is that going to reduce risk of back injuries and back pain, but especially the hamstring, you know, when you can't control your pelvis and you're stuck in an anterior pelvic tilt, then that puts the hamstrings inherently at risk of injury. And I do see that, and you see it with, often it won't be as obvious or illuminated in acceleration, but when they then transition to top speed, it becomes very obvious. And you'll see it all the time. Might be good over 10, 20 yards. If it goes a little bit further, head goes back, ass goes out, and they start literally butt kicking and just wheeling out behind the body. That's going to be kind of more exaggerated than in track and field, for example. You're playing on grass, they're going to use a more ground-based strategy, right? The floor isn't going to be as reactive as if you're using a track or probably even some astro pitches that you'd see in the NFL. Especially if it's wet, you know, and so they're going to be spending a little bit longer on the floor. It's going to be a ground-based strategy that can often help acceleration. We don't want to be having loads of air time. And I think there is a bigger issue there when one of the main things that needs to be taught in acceleration, one of the earliest things is to push. It's simply, quite simply, pushing horizontally. It's the easiest way to kind of teach more efficient acceleration, but what you get with that is players kind of bounding or jumping out,
yeah,
and almost spending too long in the air. So you've got to be quite careful with how you cue it, because they still, and you will see games players especially running differently to track stars. Makes sense, they're playing a different game.
Yeah,
they also need to, they can't be up in the air in no man's land. They've got to get their foot down to control the ball for a lot of the time. What you will see is great players transitioning between the two. Like if they're on the ball, their actual strategy will change quite vastly to if they're actually making a break. I think like somebody like Gareth Bale is probably or Ryan Giggs back in the day, a really good example. If you just look at their frequency and what they're doing with their feet when they're dribbling versus, and Ryan Giggs and Gareth Bale are great examples. If they just did one of those runs where they just knock it 20 yards past the defender and they just rely on their wheels, they just switch into track star.
Yeah.
Like there's no anterior pelvic tilt. They're not leaving their legs out behind. They can just kind of switch from having to use the floor and not be up in space where they can't actually get their foot down to the ball to boom, high knees like Usain Bolt flying down the wing. So, but then not everybody can do that, you know? Not everybody can do that. There is a certain amount of inherent kind of God-given ability to that. Both of them would have run well on the track as well as good on the field. But quite often it doesn't work the other way. Like, did you see Usain Bolt playing charity matches?
Yeah.
I think Jamie Carragher beat him to like one of the little 15-yard balls or something. He just got his body in the way, knew where it was going. Usain lost a step on him. Yeah, it's not the same. It's different. It's different. So I think that's another thing is... And I've had to have this conversation a lot because you will get the naysayers that will just question, like, what are you doing? Like, you're a speed specialist. Like, it's not the same for football, blah, blah, blah. So I've had this argument a lot and I've thought it through and through. And yeah, it's different. But we can still have a lot of take-homes from, and there's a lot of advantages to training speed with players. Speed kills, it's a massively important part of the game. It's just slightly different from how we train a track star.
100%. When you were talking before, I had that goal that Gareth Bale scored in El Clasico when he knocked it round, possibly Busquets.
Yeah.
Maybe not Busquets, one of the players anyway, and went off the pitch and came back on. And then that's exactly what you mean. Yeah.
That's the one I was thinking of.
Yeah.
I wonder whether that was, I think he's got the highest GPS recorded top speed. I think maybe it was that run.
Yeah. It won't surprise me.
I'm pretty sure it was 38 kilometers an hour, which I mean, it's huge, especially on grass with fatigue. It's incredible.
Yeah.
It's incredible. And obviously nowadays, and you get it a lot, there's a lot of clickbaity titles coming out from certain news outlets and Instagram pages saying, oh, such and such a player ran this much quicker than Usain Bolt.
Yeah.
And they're using like average speed versus top speed. And it's just completely, completely flawed. And it's a silly argument anyway. It's, you know, in track and field, top speed is the, especially in the 100 meters, the guy that reaches the highest top speed wins. And those guys are built for top speed. It's very, very different. It's very, and I think, and then people will say, oh, well, 38K is nowhere near the pace of the track sprint. And of course it's not, but it's still incredibly impressive. On that surface, with that sort of fatigue, really, really impressive. I'm sure it's like, I'm sure it's probably going to equate to like 10.5, 10.6 speed for the 100 meters, which people might look at you and say, well, there's women running that, yeah, in spikes on, you know, after training their whole lives on a track surface with a tailwind. Yeah, it's very, very impressive. And yeah, that's the great example. That break by Bale, I think, is one of the better examples. Yeah.
And there's also the fact that you've got another person that can make contact with you. You've got to keep control of the ball. He went off the pitch as well, didn't he? So obviously the surface is probably going to change off the pitch as well.
Yeah.
There's so many factors in that, which is absolutely crazy. But yeah.
Yeah. He really was a freak athlete. A joy, joy to watch. Absolute joy to watch. Yeah. And you do see these freakish displays like Cristiano's jump for that header, I think 265 height for his head, off 1 foot, having to see where the ball is off a grass surface in football boots. Very, very, very impressive. And
the landing on that one as well was ridiculous, wasn't it? Because his upper body was rotating as he landed and he stuck it on one foot basically as well.
Yeah, yeah. Incredible. That's why working on snap downs and landing mechanics, silly thing to do. It's not needed.
Yeah.
I just think it's a waste of time.
Yeah. And that was incredible, and it's absolutely flown by.
Hasn't it? I can't believe we've got through almost an hour.
we could have kept going forever, but I respect your time, and I know you've got plenty going on at the minute, so I really appreciate you coming on and doing it. I think we covered some really cool stuff in there as well. So yeah, big thank you for coming on.
No problem at all. Yeah, I am super busy just organising the off-season work for the pro players that want to come along and train up here. It's me and Steve, and we're working with Boxing Science, great gym up in Sheffield. Danny was worked with many pro boxers, you know, the highest of levels. So with the endurance stuff, we often go to Danny and he helps out. And the nutritionist at Boxing Science, also the former Sheffield United nutritionist, has now gone independent with Boxing Science. So yeah, we're holding a camp up here. So it's just really taking some organising to get that all together for June. So I'm going to be straight onto that when we get off this call.
Brilliant, mate. But just give people the details of where to keep up with your work.
Yeah, so Instagram, personal pages at Ben the Bounce. My business page is at Semtech Systems. So there's a little bit more football-specific content with some of the players I work with on Semtech Systems. But for tips and tricks and just videos of me working out, then go to Ben the Bounce. YouTube, Ben the Bounce, and website, semtechsystems.co.uk.
Amazing, mate. Thanks a lot for your time.
Appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
Big thank you to Ben for giving up his time and coming on the podcast. Make sure you go and check him out if you're over on Instagram. He's got a pretty hefty following over on Instagram, so you can check him out at Ben the Bounce. and also his company Semtex_Systems for the work, like you mentioned, that he does with athletes as well. So go and give him a follow over on socials. And in terms of takeaways on this one, there was plenty again. I think some of the stuff he mentioned earlier on about the importance of acceleration and working on that with players, obviously that was coming from the background in bobsleigh as well, and some of the lessons that transfer across. He spoke about pushing heavy weights. So I actually remember Jody Franco speaking about this years ago on his podcast and saying he's seen a real transfer from pushing heavy sleds and heavy prowlers across to acceleration and hitting positions and making sure athletes are strong enough to then transfer over into speed. And that was the work that he was doing with NFL players and all the other athletes that he was working with. And it's similar to what Ben was saying in this episode. So definitely something to consider in your programming. Making the most of in-season opportunities. So we don't get loads. There's not many in terms of the fixtures reducing down. But when they do come around, it's important to take advantage of those. The other one we didn't mention was probably players being injured. It's another opportunity. Obviously, there will be restrictions depending on the injury, but they are real life situations and opportunities that will come around in season. He spoke about the importance of strength work in those times, max strength work, and getting that exposure for players. So something that he focuses on in that time is exposing players to max strength. Obviously, again, there's other aspects to consider with that if there are injuries involved and the load and everything else that goes into it. And then also the importance of sprint mechanics and working with that, working on that with players and really focusing on making players as efficient as possible in terms of their movement. So really cool stuff from Ben. I really enjoyed this chat. And again, thank you to Steve Thompson for hooking us up on this episode. I really appreciate it. If anyone does have any other recommendations of guests, people that they'd like to hear from, topics they'd like to hear covered, then reach out, because I'm always looking for guests to come on the podcast. We've got some really cool ones lined up over the next few weeks, so I'm excited to bring those to you. As always, if you've not done so, please leave us a review on Spotify. Simply click the 5 stars. iTunes, click the 5 stars and leave a short comment. And also, if you watch over on YouTube, leave us a short comment over on those videos as well. That really does help us get more eyes and ears on the podcast as well. Last thing from me, make sure to go and check out our sponsors, Hytro, Rezl and The Good Prep, all doing some amazing work and massive support for the podcast. I really appreciate their support. Thank you again for listening. I will speak to you next week for episode 287.